the Empire podcast this week, we talk Deadshot with Emil Amin, and it's time to talk about Chris's dress sense with Nick Park. Wait, no, sorry, it's actually 30 years of the wrong trousers. All that and the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that is excited to see Jason Statham return for the Little Women sequel, The Meg 2. Cannot wait.
Dies in a hail of bullets.
That's Beth.
True story.
It isn't Beth. Oh, God. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and I am stepping in for our beloved leader, Chris Hewitt, who is off at a top secret location, literally working through the night to bring you some tasty features goodness in an upcoming issue of Empire Magazine. But fear not, for I'm not alone here. I am joined by my very own book club, The Next Chapter of Companions, because yes, that's one of the films we're going to be reviewing later. We have our very own Diane Keaton. John Nugent, hello.
Oh, I'm Diane Keaton.
You're the Diane Keaton
in
this one. Yeah, the slightly, you know, quiet, quirky one.
The quirky one. Yeah, I'll take that. Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah, that's cool.
And our very own Candice Bergen, James Dyer.
I mean, that's how I've always seen myself, if I'm honest with you.
That's how I see you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, at this point, I'm not sure what I see myself. Once again, the fucking air conditioning is broken and this studio is a sweatbox, which is why we're all here in Speedos. So
we are. And I apologize for the mental image that conjures.
Hey, look, nothing like a good pair of budgie smugglers. But
did you need to grease yourself up though, James? That seemed a bit.
Well, I feel it conducts the heat away from my body. So yeah, so like a sort of thin layer of Vaseline all over the body. Yeah. I'm a bit like the Greasy Strangler, really. That's what I was going for.
That's not a reference that I really needed in my head right now. I've just had lunch and I'm very uncomfortable.
The Greasy Podder.
Oh no. Oh, that is awful. But yes, it is very hot in here. But we're going to, you know, soldier on regardless. Heroically, some would say. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't say that about us, but some people definitely would because, you know, it might fit the circumstance. Anyway, it is time, I think, to take a question, get this thing kicked off. And in response to my panicked shout out, literally 3 minutes before we started recording, I am thrilled to see that many of you rose to the challenge and came up with some very good questions. I've rejected all the ones that require serious thought and or research, but I have a couple left. This one comes from @JohnOCard on Twitter, who says, having recently watched the Dungeons & Dragons movie with all of its lovely new Northern Ireland scenery, what's your favourite, hey, I know that place, in a movie?
Oh, this is a good one. And I have an answer fully, like, loaded in the tank.
Boom, amazing.
Ready to go because it's quite recent. It was Rye Lane. I don't know if you've seen Rye Lane, but it's a wonderful, wonderful rom-com is now on Disney Plus, and
that's shot in your ends, isn't it?
It's in my yard. It's in my neighborhood. Southeast London, Peckham and Brixton, and it's on Disney Plus now. If you haven't seen it, I really, really recommend it. It's incredibly charming. It's only 82 minutes long, so it doesn't outstay its welcome. Yeah. And it's one of those films where I was watching it, going, okay, I can figure out the geography of where they're going. They are staying true to the street, the actual street plans.
Yeah.
They turn a left here. They're going to go here. Yeah, I know where that is. I know where that is. They go to the Peckhamplex. They go to the Il Giardino restaurant, which I've been to. Like,
whoa.
All of these like Peckham landmarks. It's really, really good.
It's really special for that. I love that. Yeah, that's always a bit of a thrill when that happens.
And it's a sort of film as well that kind of shows off the area, like uses like wide angle lenses. And it's really like trying to like sell it as just this cool, quirky.
I mean, it is both cool and quirky.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah.
Much like Diane Keaton.
Indeed. Oh my God, it's all tying together. No, I agree with that. That was a fantastic one recently. And I don't know if people have noticed, I'm Northern Irish. So all of that Dungeons & Dragons stuff also worked for me. I was like,
Hang on. So you're saying that you're from Faerûn?
I am from Faerûn, yes. So the bit like when they're sitting on the beach talking about what they're going to do.
The Sword Coast, yes.
And he's trying on the helmet and trying to get it to work. The helm, sorry, and trying to get it to work. That's up the road from where I grew up.
It's up the Giant's Causeway.
Yeah, I was there, near there last time I was home, and it was very exciting.
Is that the same beach where Roger Jean Page walks over a rock?
Yeah, the one where he walks over a rock. Yeah, it's just along
Amazing.
The coast.
Oh.
It's actually, I think I ran over it when I did the, or very near it, when I did the Causeway Coast Marathon a few years ago, which, by the way, if anybody is a runner out there, really hard, loads of cliffs, don't do it. Terrible idea. What was I thinking? Anywho, so anytime I see like Northern Ireland on screen, like in... not to go all pilot TV podcast for a minute, but in Game of Thrones, right, when Jaime Lannister gets off the boat in Dorne, that is my beach. That is like 2 minutes from the house.
You live in Dorne.
I live in Dorne, except it's really not
Helen O'Hara, unbowed, unbent, unbroken.
That's me. Yeah. head crushed by a mountain probably at some point. But yeah, that so that is literally, you know.
So does everyone from Port Stewart look like Pedro Pascal?
If they did, do you think I would be here in London?
What I mean, this is fair.
Would I be doing here? Yeah. Why would I have left home?
Yeah. Please. Why would you have gone to London where everyone looks like the denizens of Fleabottom? Fair enough. Fair enough.
But yes, and I also have that nowadays with Greenwich.
I knew you were going to say the Naval
The
College.
Old Royal Naval College in Greenwich, which Chris and I talk about a lot because we basically live on opposite sides of it. But it is in everything.
Oh, everything.
It is in everything. Yeah. And, you know, for a good reason. Like, it's an amazing set of buildings. I was just watching some Queen Charlotte from Bridgerton recently. It's, of course, it's in there. It's always in Bridgerton.
Yeah.
It's in the Crown, always. It's in, it plays Florence in The Dark Knight Rises at the end.
Oh.
It's not Florence. That's Greenwich.
What, the very like,
the
last
very, very end. Yeah.
I did plays, not know
plays,
that.
It plays, I think, Moscow in The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
What is it in
Red
Cruella?
2. It was, it plays Regent's Park in Cruella. It plays itself really well in Thor The Dark World.
Yes, yeah.
You know, it's got range, is what I'm saying. Oh, and it's in both Sherlock Holmes, Guy Ritchie's movies.
Is it now?
Yes. And it plays a place that you can see Piccadilly Circus from in that ridiculous movie with The Rock in it.
Was
it
you might need to narrow that down one? A touch.
I think it was a Fast and Furious.
Yeah, it was the one where they're in London, isn't it? Which is Fast...
Six?
Yeah, the one where they go to London. Yeah.
Or no, it was Hobbs and Shaw, I think.
Is it?
I think it's Hobbs and Shaw, that one.
I mean, look, I'm not one to even intimate that all those films basically blend together, but, you know.
I think it's Hobbs and Shaw where they look out like an archway, which is in Greenwich, and they can see Piccadilly Circus.
Yes, when they can see Hobbs or Shaw. Yes,
exactly.
Indeed. I wish I had a better answer for this. And it actually wounds me because I hate Camden so much. But it got to the point, and you know, maybe it is because I have an abusive relationship with that place, but it got to the point where any time I saw, I'd get a bit excited when I saw Camden in something.
Yeah.
So like when Camden was in Eternals, I was like, oh my God, a bus got turned into petals right by Camden Lock. And that's just around the corner from the office. And it really excited me. But in a way that something like This Year's Love, which is set exclusively in Camden Town, did not. Do you remember this? From, oh God, I want to say the late 90s.
David Grayson.
No, it must be early noughties.
Is it early noughties?
Song. Is it? I think it was early noughties.
It definitely is that song. That song is on the soundtrack. Yeah, it's got a frog smoking a cigarette on the poster. Kathy Burke's in it as well.
Okay.
Anyway, so This Year's Love, set in Camden. I think it's Dougray Scott, isn't it, too?
Okay.
I mean, I saw it once about however many years ago. But anyway, so I don't, like, where I grew up in Pinner, there's not an awful lot of, you know, like, Hollywood don't come a-calling a great deal. An episode of Touching Evil starring Robson Green shot not just in Pinner, but in my actual road. And you can see my actual house in that. I believe it was a stand-in for Germany, and it was a paedophile who lived on my road. So that was, nice. Was lovely.
Nice.
So we've had that. And, you know, the, Jane March, the sinner from Pinner, obviously came from Pinner, but the sinner was not shot.
Obviously.
Not sinner. What was it called? Was it called The Lover? The Jane March film, where it was all very controversial and the Daily Mail had conniptions about it.
I mean, that doesn't narrow it down.
He doesn't really, does it? Anyway, the sinner from Pinner, she obviously came from there. But yeah, so that's about it, really. I don't have... Nothing really gives me the tingles in that way when I'm like, ooh, look at that, except for London as a whole.
Yeah, it's London films, isn't it? Where I'm the same. I grew up in like rural Herefordshire, which is not, you know, a Hollywood hotspot.
Yeah, not in that many Marvel movies.
There are very few, sheep farmers gracing our golden big screen. London films, I guess, like I had that with Last Night in Soho.
Yes.
Yes,
I watched that at Prince Charles Cinema, which is literally, you know,
100%
in the neighborhood in which it's set, which is really fun.
And that's another film where the geography
pretty much
makes sense. Like it, you know, if she turns a corner, she turns a corner onto the street she actually turns onto.
You could map it and it would work. Like Edgar Wright is a stickler for that sort of thing. Similar with Attack the Block. That's, again, sort of more southwest London. Like, I watched that at the Ritzy in Brixton, and the first shot of that film is like an overhead shot of Oval Tube Station, which is just up the road from there. And, you know, a little,
little
smatter of applause came when I watched it. People were just like, I know that tube station.
I also have one more.
Yeah.
So I did a year in Paris when I was at university.
It's Paris, Helen.
Okay. J'habitais à Paris, you know, à l'université.
All right, steady.
Okay. And I lived at the very bottom of a fancy street called Avenue de Breteuil. And we had like a little flat that was just carved out of one of those big Parisian buildings. And we were very lucky to have it. And it was the most amazing place in some ways that I've ever lived. But it was, so this street ran straight up to the Invalides, the big building with the golden dome in Paris. And when I watched Ronin, and you see all the car chases that go around Paris, and some of the geography makes sense, some of it really doesn't. But there is a moment where they're driving around, they're in the middle of a car chase, the worst of the danger has passed, and they have to pull over to the side of the road because Sean Bean is about to throw up. He threw up on my street. And me and my friends were like watching that movie, like nudging each other, going, that's our street. We were so delighted to have Sean Bean throw up on it.
And who wouldn't be?
Did you say
he's a legend?
One does not simply throw up on Helen's street.
One does not simply vomit onto our doorstep. What colour was your boat house, Helen? That's not a euphemism.
At Hereford. Well, never went to Hereford.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Hereford, and Robert De Niro calls it Hereford.
Hereford.
Which people in Hereford find very funny.
So that's
probably why he didn't get the answer.
Yeah,
right,
that's it.
Exactly. He didn't recognize it.
What the fuck is Hereford?
Hereford.
And also, Leicester Square.
I mean, there's an SAS camp in Hereford, but there's no boathouse because there's no, like...
It's landlocked, isn't it?
I mean, maybe there's a boathouse by the river.
But that's the point, isn't it?
He's testing him, but badly.
I actually spent a while when I was living in Paris looking for those steps that the cafe is at the bottom of. They're up in Montmartre, obviously, but I find right steps after a little while. Yeah. So that was personal as well.
I remember, maybe this is from the John Wick spoiler chat we had, but I remember you getting quite annoyed at the geography of that film, right?
He could have just got to the Montmartre really easily. He didn't have to go past
the... Could have got a cab or something.
But see, that doesn't bother me so much. The things that bug me so much is like Thor the Dark World when he's on... Is it the Jubilee line? What's he on?
That's the famous one,
And it's like, where are you going? You're going to Greenwich and he's on... Is he on the Central line? What line is he on?
This is the problem. He gets on at that unused platform that they have at Charing Cross, right?
And ends in Greenwich.
And she says it's like two stops to Greenwich because obviously she wants to snuggle up to Thor for a bit. Now, in fairness... On the train, if he'd been on the train, it would have been three stops to Greenwich until they did all that work in London Bridge and changed the routes a bit.
Sure.
So it would have kind of worked. But like on the tube, like, come on, she's just...
I mean, I suppose for the sake of kind of narrative momentum, you don't always say, well, you want to go down and change the Piccadilly line, go across to... Then walk across the platform and then you're going to have to wait a bit because there's interrupted service and there's engineering works.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you need to streamline.
I would have said to Thor, you know, you need to download City Mapper, mate.
Like, absolutely. It saves you so much time. Get a fucking Uber, honestly. Yeah. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Transport for London site, mate, will sort you out. Journey planner on there. Yeah.
I mean, talking of tubes, I remember first moving to London and getting very excited when I saw Tottenham Court Road tube station for the first time.
Why?
Because of, do you know which film I'm talking about?
No.
American Werewolf in London.
That was invited to be my guest.
Yes, because it looks nothing like that now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's changed quite a lot.
A little bit, just a little bit.
But, you know, it still has a bit of that, like, you know, if you're going home late at night and you're by yourself in the tube, it has that eeriness where you feel... Oh, maybe I'm being chased by a werewolf.
That is true.
No?
All right. Well, I think we've successfully demolished that question. Everything else, I'll be honest, guys, you've asked us stuff that involves research or thought.
Yeah, I mean, don't be ridiculous. We are not prepared to put in that kind of effort.
We just don't have the time for that kind of thing. But thank you, Jono, for that question. And if you would like to have your question read out in the Empire podcast and treated with the respect which it deserves, well, maybe just send it preemptively. To be honest, before the panic shout out from myself or Chris, with the hashtag Empire Podcast. We are, of course, at Empire Magazine on Twitter. And there are other ways of getting in touch, but let's be honest, we never check them. So you're best going on to Twitter, even though it's a hellscape now. Okay, so time, I think, for a guest. And we have two this week. I'm going to start off with Amil Amin, who broke through in Kid Adulthood, starred in Yardie as well, and was seen last year, I think, in Boxing Day, which, of course, as a Christmas movie, came in for the Bah Humbug
I do
treatment.
Enjoy a boxing movie.
Yeah. I mean, there were some punches thrown, as I remember. You know, it had some stuff going on. It's also, of course, as James will no doubt butt in and tell us, he also appeared in I May Destroy You. Very, very talented actor. And this week, he appears in Deadshot, which is a Sky original movie about an IRA man played by Colin Morgan and an SAS sharpshooter who is played by Amin. So we sent Amon Worman along to talk to him just this week. Please enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the star of Deadshot, Mr. Amil Amin. How are you, sir?
I'm very happy, man. Very happy and very happy to be speaking to you with your Barry White voice. Like, we've done this before. And you come with the sexy this time. I feel you, bro.
Look, you know, when a melamine is on the pod, certain things have
certain
to be
things
done.
Go on.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But first of foremost, congratulations on this film. I have to say, this film has one of the most intense opening scenes I've seen in a long while. What was your initial reaction to seeing the character you play, or reading the character you play, rather, shoot a pregnant woman in the first 5 minutes of this film?
I was like, yes. I was like, yes, I'm going to play a hated man. The script for me was like, I think it's like 88 pages, really taut, tight, intense, you know, no time to breathe type of stuff. You know, it reminded me of something quintessentially British, but also quintessentially like 70s, that type of old school filmmaking, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver. You're following two characters where you're not sure whose side of the line you're on, especially with Tempest. Tempest, you don't really know who he is. He doesn't really know who he is. So I found that compelling. I often play characters that have a particular clarity on trajectory, you know, and with this guy, it was totally different. You know, I don't even think he feels like he's out for revenge necessarily, you know?
That's interesting because, you know, I do a lot of interviews with actors and a lot of them say, we're always on the character side, no matter what. Are you an actor who thinks that way? And did you find that challenged? If so, with a character like this, would, as you say, the don't quite know which side the audience should be on at various points?
Yeah, I don't think I'm an actor that's always like, you know, the character's always right. I don't think that I've got too much of an opinion myself to do that. But with this particular guy, Tempest, I think he's just lost. I mean, Tempest is not even going to be his real name, is it? You know, he's someone that's changed his identity. He's someone in the late 70s, 80s that's not really culturally connected to Black culture necessarily. He's completely abandoned it. After he does this, he shoots this lady and has to go back to family. The only woman, the only person he's got is this woman that he is in love with. You know, where's the rest of his family? You know, where's his mother? Where's his father? Is he Black British Caribbean, Black British African? Like, where's the cultural roots? There is none. He's very English. And, you know, he's a sergeant at that particular time. What's he had to do? Who's he had to become to be that type of person? So these questions, kind of, I answered them. But yeah, I don't necessarily agree with his way of living, but I very much empathize with the fact that some people's journey in this life is quite lonely, man, and obsolete. And also how much, you know, without the foundations of family and friendships and support, how isolated you can feel. When you're isolated and you long for that human connection, how much you can be stirred down a particular direction, you know? So I like to explore all those things because it's not something that I've done before with a character, and it's certainly not indicative of my life.
I think you touched on it a little bit there, but I wanted to ask you because I read an interview where you said you described your acting style as accidentally method, which I found very interesting. How did that manifest itself on this film with this character, with Tempest?
Do you know what, with this one, not so much, you know? I mean, it's the circumstances and the situation leads you to be accidentally method, which means you're kind of in the energy of that person. You're kind of in the tonal, you know, if he's a cello, you're playing the cello. You know, if he's a violin or piano, you're doing that instrument. So I find myself definitely accidentally method leaning, because I take on so much information about the person, and in between cut and action or in the trailers, I'm constantly thinking about things from that person's point of view. So yeah, it happens to me, but it wasn't extreme on this one for me. You know, Yardley was a bit more extreme. I just played Martin Luther King. That was more extreme. You know, I purposely lean towards that on those particular journeys, but it just happens sometimes, you know.
Definitely want to ask you more about that Martin Luther King picture. I'm very excited for that film. But I wanted to ask a little bit more about the directors for this one, Charles and Tom Gard, who I think they said that they were inspired by films like The French Connection and Get Carter. Do you yourself have a favorite revenge thriller that you like to watch? And did you take any inspiration from any of them as you were gearing up for this film?
I watched Heat again. I watched Heat. It's a really well done film. It's because you're just waiting for that moment for De Niro and Pacino to meet. You know what I mean? I watched Heat. I watched more the lonely, isolated journey of like Taxi Driver. There Will Be Blood. You know, characters that you just don't understand and you don't really get a full understanding of them. Even though Tempest is a lot less in charge of himself as Daniel Day-Lewis's character was. But, you know, Travis Beagle, you know, I even chose a coat that was kind of like that because he just don't know himself, man. I find that really a scary notion, you know. And so I kind of lent more towards that. And then was up in Scotland filming. I didn't really know anybody there myself, you know, so that lent to that feeling, you know, being a bit isolated. I didn't travel much. I stayed there. And so these things help through osmosis.
Another cool thing about this film is that it's set in the 70s. I always loved the period details in a film like this, and the period details in this film in particular are great. Was there any favorites that you had in that regard? I've never seen, but it's been a while since I've seen so many phone booths in the film.
Right.
And that was a blast from the past.
It was like, to me, it was a couple of things. It was like the way they shot the club scenes of that, with that red and that green. My dad owned a club in the 80s and 90s. And I just remember it, that kind of, that, you know, the strobe lighting. You know, that was quite nostalgic for me. I thought what they did with, there's a scene with Felicity where she's printing out pictures of Tempest. And I thought that was proper 70s. Like, she's got the glasses on, it goes into it. I remember this as well. Just having this memory. My uncle, Emsley, used to take photos and he had to print them and it would be at my dad's office. And, you know, you'd put them in the dark room and they come to light, you know? Damn, that shit. I'm old enough to remember that. But it's like, yeah, that shit was incredible during that time, you know? So those are the things that brought me back to the nostalgia, and definitely the bus stops. When I'm doing that walking thing down London, it's the London I remember as a kid, you know?
I'm always fascinated by this. You're not just working with one director, you're working with two directors. Did you ever sort of, how was that experience for you? Did you go to one director for one thing, another person for another, or they're always simpatico and they're always sort of basically saying the same thing when you're going to them?
They're not always simpatico. No. Not always simpatico. It's interesting. It's really interesting. They're very, they discuss quickly. They're like twinish in that way. And that was cool. And it made, and they didn't, to my memory, didn't have many, if any, disagreements. But they definitely had different ideas in different moments, and you have to unify them and go, okay, which one we're going with for the second. They really work well together, man. They really work well together. And as a, I remember asking that question when I began. I was like, so how is it? Who's like? But they have quite a seamless language together, but not always simpatico, and that makes for momentary interesting debate between. You've got three minds on it instead of, you know, two. I don't think I could do that as a director. I'm not sharing that shit.
Well, I was going to ask you, you recently became a director with Boxing Day a couple of years ago. And I know that as an actor, you're always learning from set to set and picking up tips. Was there any directorial tips that you picked up from these guys that you're looking to apply in future?
They know this. I mean, they are filmmakers. And they know their stuff from a camera point of view. They know their stuff from a cinema point of view. The action pack. My next film that I'm directing, that I wrote, has got elements of big action. And so that's something I'm going to have to, it's totally new to me. So I'm going to have to get really attuned to that and how that's done and different ways of doing it. And my film's also set in different time periods, not just one. And so it's going to be challenging to really establish the aesthetic of each bit and bring it together stylistically for how I want it to be.
You mentioned earlier Sophia Brown's Ruth, that I want to sort of come back to that, because yes, this is an action thriller, but I love that the film made time for that relationship and to give us a little slice of what the Black British culture was like back in the day. Can you talk about working with Sophia Brown and those scenes and bringing that to life? Because for me,
she came in last minute and really just lit the film up, man. Lit it up with a different dynamic, and She's a really instinctive performer. And it was really nice, man, just really nice. I think because we got along so well so quickly, the friendship. So I really liked her. I look forward to seeing more of her work because I didn't know her before. But I think, you know, I think she's on a good trajectory for sure.
Obviously, this takes place in the 70s. What is something that we have in Black British culture now that we don't see a lot of on screen that you wish we would?
I think I want to see... I mean, I know Ratman's done some superhero thing, so that's going to be...
Yes, I'm very excited for that. Netflix.
Yeah, that's got raps for that. Just big world building, you know? Big world building and putting us in those spaces. And to be honest, I actually want to see a lot of the Black British actors that have done so well internationally. Wouldn't it be exciting to see us all in a film? It's like we always wanted to see Will and Denzel in a movie and never quite happened. You know, I would love to see the Black British actors that are, you know, that are doing super well. You know, all of us coming together and, you know, like oh, do you know what would be good? Like an Ocean's 11 type thing.
Yes. Yes.
Put all the faces that are doing well in this Ocean's 11 star thing. It's modern. Everybody's dressing in like, you know, Oswald Boatang suits. You know what I mean? Like,
you know, dude, having a visa. Why are you not writing and directing this right now?
I think I am, man. You inspired the idea, man.
Magic has just happened in this room.
Right.
When it comes to pasta.
Yo, fam, what are you saying on this thing?
All I ask for is 20% of that. 20%. I think
20.
That's reasonable.
Woof. Yeah.
There is that very pointed line in this film that you are a Black man in the white man's world, which definitely stuck out to me. For you, is that also true of Hollywood? And if so, how have you gone about navigating that space as your career has progressed?
It'd be unrealistic of me to not look at the business that we're in, or, you know, Deadshot or some Sky, and, you know, all the fact that we are quote-unquote minorities in majority countries, you know, like in the West, and say that that hasn't got a great influence over our existence and fighting for our space and our particular, our culture, who we are within that framework. But yeah, I don't tend to look at that like that. I don't think I tend to look at like that. Hollywood, you know, it's challenging at times, man. You know, you're navigating a career. What I've done for me, I reckon, is I've become a part of the answer, which is like, okay, if you're making Ocean's 11, right, you're going to put one. Thing, yeah. If you're making an Ocean's 11, you're putting one guy in there, right? You're putting one representative. Whereas, you know, if you become a writer director and you have, you're using the pen, then you're able to make something that encompasses many people. You know, and so I like that. I like the idea of that. And I've become, I hope I'm becoming a solution-oriented person when it comes to that. You know what I mean? Because that would just be dope. Just that, again, go back to the Ocean's 11 thing. That would just be dope. I'd go and watch that. You know what I mean? So
100%. Me too. I know that you've spoken before about splitting time between UK and the US, and you're in the UK now. How has that evolved for you over time? And what do you feel needs to happen in the UK arts world, maybe, in order to better retain diverse talent and nurture diverse talent here?
I think it's happening, man. Like, the writers are coming up. I feel like the writers are the new superstars of the business. Like, you know, Kay Nicole, and they just did that film, Rye Lane. I think it's happening. Yeah. I think it's happening. You know, I think our culture has become a fascination to the world. And so I think people are engaged. And the more things are successful, then the more, you know, people are going to turn their eye to it. You know, I don't know if we'll ever be able to compete in a similar way at it like Hollywood, because it's just a numbers game at that point, right? You're talking about a country of 300 million versus a country of 60 and then a London culture. And yeah, so I don't think the competition is the framework. I think we are retaining, and people are interested in coming back and making stuff. And certainly my generation of people, I see them doing the dual moves, you know, making stuff there, making their name international, you know, and then coming home and making dope stuff. You know, I feel like that's happening. I think we're in it now. I think we're in the 70s of filmmaking in England. You know what I mean? Like, when you had George Lucas and who was Lucas, Spielberg, Scorsese, the Godfather director.
Francis Ford Coppola.
You just had, you know, I think we're in that, in its own inception.
You mentioned there playing Martin Luther King in Austin. When you get offered something like that, is it an immediate yes from you, or are you, there's certain questions you're asking yourself before you commit to a role like that?
You should say yes, isn't it? Say yes. You say what? Yes. You say what and yes. That's the two. That's the two things. You know, you say what and yes. Is there trepidation? Are you, do you get nervous and fearful? And yeah, you do, because it's such a mountain to climb, isn't it? It's such a mountain to climb. So yeah, I think you say yes and yes, yes, yes. Thank God. What? How? And let's see what happens, you know.
I've heard that this is the first time that the Eye of a Dream speech is getting to be actually read in the film on screen, because up until that point, up until last night, it hadn't been allowed to be. What was that moment like filming that, knowing that? I mean, I guess, is that something you have to sort of divorce and forget about as you're in it, or are you thinking about that in any way, shape, or form as you're performing it?
I'm not thinking about that at all. And I think, again, the idea of being method leaning helps with that, because the Mel's mind is quietened, you know, the Mel brain is quietened, and I'm more living in the space of what I imagine through research King's mental space to be in at that moment. You know, I did that scene, I want to say about 30 or 40, I did that speech about 30 to 40 times over 2 days. In my career, it's probably the greatest to achieve that and to feel it and to be in it and to not be judging myself, but just be in it. It's, yeah, without a shadow of doubt, the greatest accomplishment of my career as an actor.
So excited to watch it. Even more excited to see your Ocean's 11 film. That's gonna be amazing.
Me too, man. You might have a cameo. You'll keep your voice like this, though.
Okay. Yeah. No. By the way, I got you. I'm a work on it. I'm not working anymore. Another mean. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, bro. See you again, man.
All right, that was Emile Amin, and we will be talking about Deadshot in the review section a little bit later. But before that, it is time to talk about this week's movie news. Now, obviously, I've referred to perhaps the biggest story of this or any week, the Meg 2 trailer coming out. But let's start there. What did we think of the Meg 2 trailer?
I loved it. I'm going to start saying Meg in the manner in which you guys say Dune now.
Meg!
I am so, so excited for this film.
What is this film?
I truly didn't believe, even I still don't quite believe it's a thing that exists. I mean, to have a sequel to it in itself is quite funny, but to have a sequel directed by
Ben fucking Wheatley.
I don't know. Ben Wheatley.
Do you think he lost a bet? Like, genuinely, like, how has this come about?
I mean, would it be losing or winning a bet?
I mean, you know what? This is a valid point. I confidently believe that if someone went up to Martin Scorsese with a script for Crank 3, he'd fucking jump at it. So
I enjoyed that Rook Films, which is his production company, tweeted, from the director of Down Terrace comes the Meg 2, The Trench. I loved the look of this trailer. I thought it was really funny. I mean, it has this hilarious cold open, which set in prehistoric times, where there's just some dinosaurs hanging out on the beach and a T-Rex is like, you know, dominating. And then the Meg just eats him whole as if to say, look, this is the biggest dinosaur in the world. You need to be scared of it. And then it just has Jason Statham ready to punch him in the face, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Shark puncher.
Shark
puncher. Not just Meg, but Megs.
Megs.
Yes, Megs. And also other creatures as well, which I'll be honest, I wasn't expecting. I thought this was going to be a shark-focused movie, but we got tentacles.
We got
stuff going on here, there's, man. It's a whole ecosystem.
It has the whiff of Sharknado about it, doesn't it? Like, there's a hint. I mean, I don't believe that's what it's going to be, because I feel like Ben Wheat is in on this joke. Like, there's no way he's in on this joke.
He has a sense of humor.
Exactly.
And I think there may be an element of this is, you know, slightly one for them. Like, this will fund his next, like, weirdo, low-budget horror kind of thing.
Knowing the budgets he uses, probably his next 10 budget horrors. Yeah.
But yes, I think there is a knowing sense of humor to it. I think Statham knows what he's doing as well. He's having fun with it. Like, the first one was not a serious film. There's a sequence where a Yorkshire Terrier is swimming through the water and being pursued by a giant ancient shark. You know, these are not serious films. And this one, I think, is very much in that vein. I'm very excited. I can't help myself.
It's Jason Statham not just punching one prehistoric shark, but punching many prehistoric sharks. And I think we can all agree that that is the direction in which cinema should go.
Yeah, so. That's right, yeah. It follows the alien to aliens rules. You
absolutely.
Know, you just add a plural. And
indeed.
But yeah. Shouldn't it be the Megs too? Like
Megs.
The Megs.
Megs. Just Megs.
Just Megs.
Megs.
Meg harder. I don't know. Yeah, Megs doesn't quite have the same menace.
I guess
maybe.
Not. Yeah. Two little women.
Two women, yeah.
It would be funny if they followed up the Megs with, you know, the Meg with the Beth, the Joe and the Amy. Like, that would be pretty epic.
As far as spin-offs go, yeah, all of whom died in a hail of blood.
Just giant prehistoric women.
eating men.
Marauding
yes.
women. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there we go. Okay. Here's some news I didn't see coming. Nicolas Cage is going to star opposite Bill Skarsgård in Lords of War. And
what
if you're thinking
fuck?
To yourself, hey, that name is slightly familiar, this is apparently a very belated sequel to Lord of War from 2005,
yes.
The Andrew Niccol film.
Which I spent a week on set of.
Yeah, and now it's we're back.
Hang on, so this is getting the Alien to Aliens sequel treatment.
He has a son.
This is the one that is getting the Alien to Aliens
plural sequel.
Lords of War.
Yeah.
Huh. It's absolutely wild. This is mad because Andrew Niccol's a great filmmaker and I was literally on set of this for a week. So it was independent at the time, didn't have a distributor. And they just flew me out, I was in Cape Town, South Africa, and put me up in an apartment and I just hung out on the set of this film for a literal week. It was wild. And this film, I don't think, did a great deal of business. I'm very surprised it's getting a belated sequel, but yeah. I really enjoyed it. I like the idea of him as this kind of, you know, this arms dealer and how he kind of fit into this. There's a really great scene in it where he realizes that he's in over his head when someone takes one of his guns and shoots someone in the face and he's shitting himself and he styles it out as a kind of like, he's like, and he freaks out and the guy like looks at him and he's like, I can't sell a used gun, you know, and it's just like, that's his whole spiel. And what was really interesting was when because they gave me the script when I was on set and I read through the entire script and I really latched onto that scene. And I remember discussing the scene with Cage before he shot it.
Oh.
And he was talking to me about, I haven't really worked out how I'm going to play it. I was thinking of this and maybe doing that. And he was just talking through, just spitballing ideas of how he was going to play the scene. And then watching him then do that, that was wild.
Oh,
I really
cool.
enjoyed that.
Yeah.
It was
that's
a great
amazing.
Episode.
Peeking
but
behind the cage process.
It was. I felt I was inside my inner cage. Interestingly enough, he went shark diving in a cage that very day.
Really?
Cage.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was telling
cage.
Me about it. Yeah, he went, it was a cage in a cage and he went shark. He went diving with great white sharks.
Amazing.
Did he punch any of them?
I didn't ask him whether he punched one, but I suspect, you know, he was channeling his inner
statement. This is why he didn't get the role in the Meg.
Yeah. That is why.
Yeah. You know,
should have punched one.
Punch the shark.
This is not
in production yet. It's up for sale at the Cannes film market, but it does have Niccol returning. It does have basically Bill Skarsgård playing the sort of long lost son.
Mm.
Of Cage's character, Yuri. So he will be not trying to right his dad's wrongs, but trying to top them. And there's even a story here that they might be going rivals for the same woman as well, which means that somebody is dating way out of his age range. I'm just saying. Yeah, that's going to be, I guess, an interesting one. I didn't see that coming. I didn't think that would be.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really remember the original film except for the amazing opening sequence. Do you remember this?
The
sequence that just follows the life cycle of a bullet.
It's great.
Which I thought was very smart and cool. But
and the poster, you remember the poster was Cage's face made up of bullets.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Which is another good one, yeah. Genuinely no one has seen this film.
I don't think
I've ever met anyone who has watched
it. I have seen it.
From
us. Okay, well, yeah.
I'll have to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Yeah. It's a great performance from him. And Jared Leto's good in it too.
What else took your caught your eye this week?
I don't know if I haven't listened to the latest podcast yet, so I don't know if you talked the new Taika Waititi project. Have you talked about this yet?
Tell me more.
Taika Waititi is adding to his stacked calendar. I don't know, you know, he's got a spare half an hour a day in which to work on something else. So he's decided to direct something called Clara and the Sun.
Yes, we actually forgot to talk about this last week. It was last week's news, but we failed miserably to talk about it. So this is based on the Kazuo Ishiguro story, is that right?
Yeah, it's a novel about a robot girl who is created to prevent teenagers from becoming lonely. And it's a story of how she tries to save a family of humans she lives with from heartbreak.
So it's kind of the reverse of After Yang.
I guess so.
Which was about a family of humans.
Before Yang, yeah.
That was a family of humans trying to save their robot boy so they'd be saved from heartbreak. So it's kind of an interesting.
So, okay. You know, that sounds interesting. I mean, he's also got, you know, a Star Wars movie, a small matter of a Star Wars movie supposedly happening. We haven't heard much about
that. It's one Star Wars movie, John. How long can that take? $10? Come on.
Very good. He's supposed to be doing Flash Gordon as well. And he also has, you know, Next Girl Wins, which is out later this year. But I think that's done now, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
finished.
He's got some Roald Dahl stuff as well with Netflix. Isn't he doing like the Oompa Loompas series or something?
I don't know if that's highly anticipated Oompa Loompa series.
I don't know.
If Taika is into it, there must be a reason, we hope. So fingers crossed for that. I'm surprised, James, you haven't already trampled all over us to tell us about the most fascinating James news of the week.
Well, it depends on which one you would pick. I'm actually going to surprise you and say something you wouldn't think, which is the game night news, and which is cheating because we broke this news. The news was, when talking to Rachel McAdams, she was saying that her mum saw Game Night and was like, you have to do a sequel. So we were like, hey, Rachel McAdams' mum wants Game Night too. But the best part of this particular story is the fact that Jonathan Goldstein then retweeted that and was like, this is a lot of pressure. So clearly, he is going to bow to the pressure of Mrs. McAdams, and he's gonna make Game Night 2.
Game Night 2 then, 100% definitely greenlit.
Definitely confirmed here.
Because of a throwaway line published in Empire magazine.
100%.
This is amazing
news. We did it, guys.
We did it.
We did it. Yeah. It is a great, if there's anybody out there listening to this podcast who hasn't already seen Game Night, I doubt it because we've raved about it so much. But if you are that person, please do go watch Game Night. And if you've already seen it, watch it again. For the... Oh no, he died.
Was it the Arnold news? Is that
no,
the one?
No, it wasn't even that. Other one.
Well, okay. Well, I'm going to mention the Arnold news. So Arnold is a new documentary, which is coming. Obviously, FUBAR, his series is coming up. Less said about that, the better. But he has Arnold, which is this 3-part documentary, and kind of the tagline for this is "One Man, Three Lives." So I guess it's going to chart his bodybuilding, his acting, and his political career. I am totally up for doing this. We're absolutely going to review it on the Pilot TV podcast. I'm going to make Boyd and Kay watch all 3 episodes of this. Because it's Arnold, the documentary.
Arnold, the documentary. I mean, you know, 80 stars doing documentaries is a thing at the moment. We'll be talking about that in the review section.
We will.
Oh, yeah.
So it does feel like he's kind of got some stories to tell if he will tell them.
Well, that's the question. The question is, will it be sort of a little bit whitewashed of some of the seedier aspects? I don't know. I'll be interested to see. But this drops on Netflix on the 7th of June. So, June! That's exciting stuff. Well, tell me, what is the news that I should have clearly told you?
I thought you would be all excited about the spin-off movie Bird Box Barcelona.
See, I knew this was happening, so I didn't realize this was news. Because this is news.
Yeah, there's an announcement.
Yeah, hasn't it got a date? Or?
It has, July 14th.
Yeah, so it's a weird spin-off, isn't it? Obviously, my beloved Bird Box, starring Sandra Bullock, which was on one of Netflix's... I think it's actually been one of their most successful original movies.
I believe so, yeah.
I absolutely loved it. I may be, if not alone, certainly quite solitary in this particular camp. But I think it's great. So Bird Box Barcelona means that the aliens also end up in Spain. And so it's a Spanish language spin-off / sequel.
Yeah.
Bird Box Barcelona, which is a lot of B's for a film title.
It's pleasingly alliterative.
Bird Box Barcelona.
Certainly. Bird Box Barcelona.
Are they only going to do spin-offs in places that start with B?
Yes.
Bird Box Belfast should be exciting.
Bird Box Brooklyn.
Bird Box Belgium?
Bird Box
Belgrade. Bruges right there.
Yeah. Bruges.
Bird Box Bruges. Bird Box Bruges.
I fucking hate Bruges.
But genuinely, I implore everyone who has not seen Bird Box, or even if you have, to revisit it or watch it for the first time, because it's great.
All right, it's just a Quiet Place wannabe. But
it's
okay.
Brilliant.
Anyway, this one will be directed by Alex and David Pastor, and fingers crossed.
But there's a sequel. There's a sequel novel to the novel Bird Box. There's a sequel. So presumably that's not what this is based on. So like, there's a sequel right there. Can we not have like...
I mean, it's not an either or. It could be both.
Or both.
Yeah, you know.
Bird Box Bruges is now in production, so...
Once again, our immense power to greenlight films.
Yeah. I have personally spoken to Rachel McAdams' mom, and she was 100% behind Bird Box Bruges happening.
Well, there you go. Okay. Rachel McAdams' mom wants,
she gets.
And I'm hearing Rachel McAdams' mom also says the Meg 3 and 4 are currently in production.
I heard that too, yeah. I think she's really keen on those.
It's Meg M3G.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what the fourth one is.
Do we know her position on Beetlejuice 2?
You say it three times, Helen, not twice.
Oh, okay. Well, that does change things. But it doesn't change the fact that Justin Theroux has signed up to join the cast.
Yeah, and Jenna Ortega, who will presumably be punching up the script, is coming in to take on the Winona Ryder role.
Yeah, so this is, it's kind of a sequel though, right? Is she technically...
I'm unclear. I'll be honest, I don't fully understand what this is.
Yeah, so I think Ryder is playing her own role. I think she's still Lydia, but her Wednesday, you know, follower, Jenny Ortega, is also going to be in it as her daughter.
Oh, okay, so she's the daughter of Lydia.
Yeah,
she's not actually playing Lydia.
They're not rebooting it.
So you're telling me that I really should have actually bothered to read the entire news story and not just scan the headline?
You are the editor of the site.
I mean, look, this is the kind of journalistic integrity I'm not prepared to give you, so...
Okay, well, we don't know who he's playing.
Because we're not going to read the story, quite frankly. We're not prepared to.
Also, it hasn't been announced who he's playing. That's the actual reason that we don't know.
If we say your name three times, James, do you go away?
I do. Yes, that's true. I will vanish instantly.
Okay. Well, there's something to remember. That's a useful note from John.
Say my name five times in the mirror and just see what happens.
Okay.
Say my name. I'm just excited, actually. I think Jenny Ortega and Winona Ryder teaming up is instantly fun.
That's the goth Avengers, basically, isn't it?
And it kind of is. It's like having played, you know, the young Wednesday and taking over from Christina Ricci there, and now playing, you know, Lydia's daughter and sort of taking over from Winona Ryder there. It just feels like she's bringing all our goth 90s girls back to life. Now all I need is for Winona Ryder to take the Cher role in a Mermaids remake and for her to take Winona's role in that, which I was just watching again the other day. I freaking love that film. Anyway.
Will she do the Wednesday dance to the Deo song? That's the question.
Well, now I hear that Rachel McAdams' mum is super up for that and really thinks strongly that that's something that should happen.
I feel like a banana boat, you know, like musical number needs to happen.
Fingers crossed. What other news have we got?
I will jump in with a news story. And really, I like to think of this news story as just a tease for Monday's Planet TV podcast when I'll be talking about this properly. Yeah. But Rian Johnson's poker face is finally coming to UK shores.
Yes.
And it's next week. It's next week as we go out. Well, actually, week after next, as Empire goes out, next week as Pilot goes out. Yeah, very excited coming to Sky Max because obviously it was a Peacock show. And because Peacock no longer really exists here in the UK, it just vanished into the ether.
Yeah.
And we've been waiting and waiting and waiting. But so it's going to drop on Sky Max. And I think all of them are going to drop as a box set, as Sky does sometimes. You get to watch every single Poker Face back to back. And while I have, let's be honest, very little patience for those kind of like case of the week procedural things, it's Rian Johnson.
Yeah.
It's Natasha Lyonne.
Yeah.
By all accounts, it's brilliant. Let's do this thing.
Oh, I mean, every reaction and review I've heard about the show has been, this is great. This is a really good thing.
Yeah.
And we hope it continues forever kind of thing. It's Rian Johnson in whodunit mode.
Yes.
But it's also, you know, very much built for TV, it sounds like.
The best things are, John.
It's one of those things that, yeah, they announce the US release and then they just stay very quiet about everything else. And I've, you know, just in my capacity as reviews editor, I've been just like desperately begging these random names from across the world, like VP of customer relations for Peacock or something, say, please let me watch it. I just want to watch it.
Well, I feel the same way about, because I'm a massive Anne Rice fan, and Interview the Vampire and the Mayfair Witches have yet to show any hint that they might appear on these shores. It's driving me insane, especially because they gave me Interview the Vampire screeners very early. So I've seen the first episode, but I'm able to watch the rest and I don't know when it's coming. I mean, it's a first world problem, but it's bugging me.
It's beyond a first world problem, James. And it's also TV. So
yes.
Back here in the movie news world,
nice.
Did you guys watch the Oppenheimer trailer?
Yes.
So how do you currently stand on your plans for Barbie and Oppenheimer Day? Which one will be your opener and which one your closer? You will be judged on the
it's
answer.
It's a good question, isn't it? I don't know. I feel like maybe start with Oppenheimer and then you
cheer
have like
up
a,
again
you have
Barbie.
A Barbie chaser, you know, just to like take the edge off, a bit of glitter and you know, sweet sugar to
we think
to wow. take the nuclear medicine go down.
I think it's a perfect double bill.
Yeah,
is
I
it?
Mean
anyway, yeah. But I mean, this is the other film with everyone in it. Like basically everybody, Hollywood got together, they got everybody in a room. And half of them signed up to Barbie and the other half signed up to Oppenheimer,
fair,
right?
Yeah.
With Cillian Murphy obviously leading, Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, Robert Downey Jr., Florence Pugh, Benny Safdie, Michael Angarano, George Hartnett, Rami Malek, Kenneth Branagh, Dane DeHaan, Alden Ehrenreich, and Matthew Modine. To name but a few.
Is anyone in both?
I don't believe so.
There isn't any crossover there.
No. I mean, look, this trailer I thought looked really good. The most interesting thing to me is that they're keeping to that release date. They have not blinked.
They haven't blinked.
They haven't blinked. And it's a really weird one for me because maybe correctly, they think that film nerds like us are all hyped up about this face-off for the ages and everyone else sees no overlap between these two films whatsoever. Only interested in one or other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's only the film nerds, maybe.
I think you're right.
Who are blindingly excited about
this. Oh, in my head, it's like Oasis and Blur in the 90s. You know, it's like, who is going to win? I am really excited to see like what the actual winner is.
After Super Mario's box office recently, I think Barbie is going to be the box office winner.
Yeah. I 100% agree with that.
I think you're probably right.
But, I mean, which one's going to sweep the Oscars? That is the genuine question. There was genuinely Oscar buzz for Ryan Gosling as Ken. No, it came from like one Twitter account, but that's enough for me to start the campaign right here.
He's going to be beating off Oscar voters.
I mean, look, I feel like if Ryan Gosling were to win an Oscar for playing Ken in the Barbie movie, I feel like it would bring about world peace and an end to global warming. That's just me, but I feel like that's what would happen.
If you say so.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm very excited for Oppenheimer, I should say. Like, it does look great from this trailer. We got a bit more of a sense of, you know, who's it looks like a kind of Cillian Murphy, Matt Damon kind of pairing. Mm. And then there's a huge ensemble backing them up. I mean, you see Florence Pugh for like a second in that trailer. Mm. And it's like,
before she dies in a hail of bullets.
I don't think she dies.
That's
in
what happens.
Bullets.
Again,
well, that's happened.
It also doesn't happen in Little Women. I cannot stress this enough. That is not a thing that happens in Little Women.
Don't remember it in the trailer, but I'll need to double check. But yeah, I mean, it's I just thought that's illustrative of how like starry this film is, that they have like one of the biggest stars in the world right now, and they're just like, just sneak
she's
her
in it too. Big deal. Yeah. Well, she was busy with her other film,
Little Women.
Her other film, Jake. Oh,
June!
My God. I set them up for you.
I know.
And you just like...
I know. She amazingly, she does not die in a hail of bullets in June.
That we know.
Mainly because they don't really use ballistic weapons an awful lot,
well,
because
exactly.
You know, of personal shielding.
Exactly,
so they're more,
yeah.
It's more of a melee-based combat. Anyway, eaten by a worm is what happens. But yeah, so what do we think? We think Oppenheimer? We're looking forward to it more than Barbie? Do we think it's going to...
Not more than Barbie.
Bomb?
Look, oh, God. I don't think it's going to bomb... Neither do I think it's necessarily going to blow up the box office.
Maybe it's mutually assured destruction.
Yes.
Like maybe they will just destroy each other in a nuclear winter.
All other films will flee that week because it will be radioactive. Or I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Any other news?
Well, we should perhaps mention that the writer's strike, the Writers Guild of America, is ongoing. There have been a few more clarifications, emerging bits and pieces this week. Tony Gilroy clarified that he has done nothing on Andor since the strike began. He has not been producing. Obviously, he hadn't been writing, but he also hasn't been producing. He also hasn't been going to the set. We've seen a lot of celebrities, of actors and so on, joining the ranks of the strikers. We've heard some noises from the DGA about their own negotiations with the studios. There is certainly no sign of the writer's resolve weakening. If anything, quite the opposite.
It feels like the... What is the acronym for the...
AMPTPA?
That's the one. It feels like they've kind of dug in a little bit, which seems to me ill-advised. Like you can't help thinking that they're going to have to blink. And they'd save themselves so much money if they just did the blinking now. Like, why draw this
out?
Well,
they're obviously aware that where the writers lead, the DGA and SAG will follow, and indeed all the other unions as well. And so I feel like they think that if they can break this one strike, that they can save themselves some money in the long term. But honestly, given the relative modesty of the writer's demands and the fact that historically the DGA and SAG have been a little bit more conciliatory in their negotiations, I feel like, you know, the momentum is still very much with the writers here. And rightly, in my view, so, because they have honor and dignity.
100%, yeah.
Righteousness on their side. So yeah, it's been good to see everybody very much sticking to their guns. And a lot of threads this week, if you look for the WGA strong hashtag or things like that on Twitter, a lot of threads from writers explaining just what the problems are, just why these arguments matter to them.
Yes.
And just how badly writers who've written on some of your favorite shows and movies have been treated by the system currently.
Well, yeah, an interesting one that's come up a lot in the negotiations is this idea of a small writer's room. Yeah. This is more of a TV than a film issue. But the idea is, and what that means and why this is bad. And I think generally speaking, someone, and forgive me, I've forgotten his name, it's a screenwriter, went and did a video explaining why that is, that traditionally what would happen is that, you know, a showrunner would come in, they'd get a script written for a pilot, it would get picked up to season, then they'd put together a writer's room and they'd hire experienced writers, the expensive ones, they'd hire some mid-level writers, and they'd hire some entry-level writers who are going to learn their craft and be the future of the industry. And the trend is moving towards this idea that instead of greenlighting something, they'll say, okay, we like this pilot, write a few more. Here's a really small budget to do that with. So then the showrunner has to put together a really tiny writer's room with maybe only a few writers, and they only hire the experienced writers, because frankly, there's an awful lot at stake, which means that these younger writers don't even get a foot in the door. But more importantly, those experienced writers have to work for a fraction of their rate because this show isn't necessarily going to series. But as was pointed out, it doesn't matter what you do with the show. It takes exactly the same amount of brain power and time to create the show. So why are you paying them a pitiful amount to do it? Mm-hmm. So it feels just massively exploitative in a way of you know, frankly, just getting something for nothing.
It also feels like something that may have very deleterious effects on what we watch. So for example, one story I saw was somebody who had had to spend 4 weeks in the writer's room breaking 10 episodes. So figuring out the plot for 10 different episodes. But then the writer's room had been dissolved and all the people who were in it, the small number of people who were in it, were sent off to essentially write an episode each. Mm. But as freelancers. So they were just going to be paid for the script that they turned in, and it might take months for them to be paid that money. And then there wasn't that same collegiality. There wasn't that chance to go back and forth to discuss things. And that means that we're going to see, you know, TV shows, for example, with less connective tissue issue episode to episode, mm-hmm. we're going to see less continuity. We're going to see less character growth, less coherent plotting, because I'm sure the showrunner then takes those and rewrites them and tries to tie them together. But you're still not going to have the level of connection and you know, consistency across the board that you would have if those people were in a freaking proper writer's room working together as an actual team. Mm. I get that the studios just want to cut costs because capitalism, but like, come on, people, like, it can't just be about putting money in the pockets of the already rich. You've also got to feed the people who actually make the product.
Yeah.
Literally feed them.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Anyway, so obviously we're entirely neutral on this and have no strong opinions on the rights and wrongs of the writers' strike, but hashtag WGA strong, as far as I'm concerned.
Indeed.
And yeah. That brings me on to some other great work by writers this week. The new issue of Empire.
Pay the writers!
Out.
Pay us, please.
We're on strike.
We're not on strike,
but please buy our magazine.
Yes,
yes, please. This is a very exciting one. This one is, of course, centered around Secret Invasion, the MCU show about what Nick Fury did while we haven't been watching. And it turns out he's been fighting with shapeshifters, which is exciting. So we're talking Parallax View, we're talking Paranoia, we're talking 70s thriller, and we're talking Samuel L. Jackson wearing great coats while fighting bad guys. We've got the entire story on that. We also have our exclusive report from Star Wars Celebration.
With lots of beautiful pictures.
Lots of gorgeous pictures. We basically set up a photo studio backstage and essentially kidnapped everyone as they came off their panels and dragged them to an undisclosed location and forced them to be pretty. So it looks fantastic, but we also got a little bit of info on what's coming from the Star Wars universe. So that was exciting. We also talked to Michael J. Fox, as his movie Still, a Michael J. Fox movie, comes out this week. We look ahead at the amazing Finnish film Sisu, which I saw yesterday. It's like, what if John Wick was taking apart Nazis? And the answer is, yay. And we have a look back at The Fugitive, among others. What else have we got?
He had a mechanical arm!
John, tell me about your section. You've got reviews this week is a mixed bunch. It's of some
a mixed
very
bunch. I'm trying to think. There's a 120 word review of the Old Man movie Blacktopolix. If you want to read my take on that, Bo is Afraid, I think, is our lead review,
is.
Which we'll be talking about on the podcast, or someone will be talking about the podcast next week. And
good luck summing that one up.
I mean, I had 500 words and I struggled. To be honest, it's a hell of a thing. There's some good films out this month though. Right?
Yeah, we've got Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. We've got The Master Gardener.
Yeah.
Fatal Attraction, if you're interested in TV, which of course is something that James does in his other job. Lots in there. We also have Chris talking to Macquarie about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. We do have the aforementioned Rachel McAdams interview. We've got Sam Hargrave talking about Extraction 2 and why he set Chris Hemsworth on fire. It turns out it's not to check if he's really Thor, which is a bit upsetting. Andy Garcia does Pint of Milk. We've also got in the review section, we've got Sam Neill. There we go. We obviously have an Event Horizon joke on the contents page. We've got Tetris, John S. Baird talking us through that. And we've got the M. Night Shyamalan ranking. So that is the new issue of Empire on sale now in all good and evil newsagents. Get after it or regret it forever. All right, time, I think, for another interview. And I'm very excited this week. We have an interview with a four-time Oscar winner. And one of the more, I think, you know, modest, reasonable, normal four-time Oscar winners that's out there. Nick Parkford is the man behind Aardman Animation. And he joined Chris this week to talk about the fact that it is 30 years of The Wrong Trousers. It's 30 years since we first saw the Wallace and Gromit movie, The Wrong Trousers, one of the all-time funniest animated movies, in my money. I think it is an incredible, incredible heist movie. An incredible comedy, and still has one of the greatest train chases ever put on film.
So good.
Amazing, amazing film. So yes, please enjoy Nick Park talking trousers.
Just jumping in, we forgot to say that this Nick Park interview is in fact just an excerpt from a longer interview that you will get to hear in full next week in a full Nick Park interview special. That's it from me. Subscribe to the Pilot TV podcast. Here's Nick Park.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast to celebrate, and I can't believe I'm saying these words, the 30th anniversary of The Wrong Trousers by the great Nick Park. How are you, Nick?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks, Chris. Yeah. Can't believe it's 30 years.
It blew my mind, honestly, when the opportunity of talking to you was first broached for this anniversary. The PR I was dealing with said, oh yeah, it's for the 30th anniversary of The Wrong Trousers. And I genuinely thought there was a typo. It's weird.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, it was always strange for me to suddenly have people, young people who were in their teens coming up to me and saying, oh, I grew up with, oh, now it's people in their 20s, you know, saying they grew up with Wallace and Gromit. And I still think it was kind of yesterday when we made it.
Because I was wondering about how the passage of time feels for a stop motion animator. I mean, do you perceive time in a different way to everyone else?
probably. I mean, I know it's the thing that people often say. You know, it takes so long. You know, needs such a lot of patience. I guess it's true. You know, there's a kind of monastic feel to the fact that you're locked in a space, you know, with usually in the dark with a few lights and only achieving a couple of seconds a day or whatever. But you learn to think like that, you know, that 2 seconds can be a heck of an achievement if it's some really nice bit of acting, you know, that you've achieved. So it can be very satisfying to do that much a day.
Absolutely. But it's interesting what you say there about time and how people perceive that stop motion animation is shot obviously very meticulously, and it takes a long, long time. But I was looking at the gaps between your Wallace and Gromit shorts, and it's interesting. There's obviously A Grand Day Out is this personal pet project of yours that you're doing pretty much in your spare time as well. Takes years to make. Comes out 1990. Within 3 years, you've made this movie. So what changed? What accelerated the process for you on The Wrong Trousers?
Yeah, well, I guess it was starting at Aardman, because A Grand Day Out was, half of it was, well, it was a National Film and TV School production. It was my student graduation film at the National Film and TV School. It took me far longer to do the first. I remember I started at film school shooting the whole of Wallace and Gromit building the rocket in the basement. And then I looked at the script and think, oh boy, I've been 6 months, a year on this. How much have I achieved off the script? And it was half a page of the script. It said, there is now follows a sequence where Wallace and Gromit build a rocket. And that's what I've done. And it's a 20-page script. So, yeah. But anyway, Aardman offered me work when I ran out of time at film school. And so then I was working part-time. Aardman gave me a corner of the studio and all kind of curtained off. And they said, finish your film here and we'll help you if you need help. But because I was part-time on it, I was pulled off all the time on TV commercials, the Sledgehammer video, things like that, exciting projects. And when I got time in between, I'd keep going. And so it took me about another 4 years to finish.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, but that's the difference, Chris. It was suddenly, I think Channel 4 bought it to start with. And then Alan Yentob, I remember a meeting with Alan Yentob at the BBC, and he said, would you like to make another one, but for the BBC? And I was already, really wanting that. So had ideas in mind. So it was a real break then to actually make it proper with a proper budget and everything, and to write a proper story. That's when I met Bob Baker, the writer.
Yeah, because did that help as well? Obviously, this is a full on Aardman production, and that must help as well in terms of getting something this complex made in a relatively short space of time, just 3 years between Grand Day Out and The Wrong Trousers. So something you're throwing all the resources of Aardman at it as well.
Yeah, that's right. It was, and had all these amazingly talented people on the lighting side, the model making. I was doing it all myself before, more or less, 99%. As from a student to a guy doing it in his spare time. I had access to model makers, set builders, set designers, art direction, camera, lighting, camera guys, animators. Well, it was still a very small crew, though, I must say, on Wrong Trousers. There were two of us, me and Steve Box, animated the whole thing with a bit of help from Peter Lord, and one or two other animators came in for a day or two. But we did 50% each, really. Steve mainly focusing on Feathers McGraw, the penguin. And I was, at that time, I was the only person who'd done Wallace and Gromit, so I was quite protective of the character. But Steve did do some animation on Wallace and Gromit.
So presumably you know the moments when you weren't animating Wallace and Gromit, when you watch The Wrong Trousers again. Can you tell when it's you and when it's Steve?
Yeah, I can. And we chose that Steve, because Steve hadn't done Wallace speaking before. And at that point, now we have a system where we have replacement mouths for Wallace. And that means that any animator can do it without the style changing, because it was still plasticine or clay. So it would evolve into somebody else's style. That's the danger. And at that point, so I stuck to all the lip sync stuff. I did any of the penguin Feathers McGraw shots when he came into a Wallace or a Gromit shot, because there can only be one animator on the set animating. So
it's incredible to me how you do what you do. And when you are coming at this, I mean, this is not to say that A Grand Day Out isn't ambitious and complex, because my God, it is. But when you're coming to this, was there a specific urge or desire on your part to increase the ambition of what you were able to do and the complexity of what you were able to pull off?
Yes. It was very, very ambitious. The whole thing was a sort of exponential curve upwards, really, a big learning curve. And from the beginning, I say this at the same time, because we were all hands-on, we'd done a lot of work, on animation ourselves, each of us, in different capacities. We came from a very hands-on approach, and so even the script would be written, I knew what would be too ambitious and what wasn't, in terms of what was it. I don't mean ambitious, we wanted to be ambitious creatively, but it was very kind of analog, old school, pre-digital, and we knew what could be achieved, and yet we wanted to push it at the same time, to kind of get further with it. And that was always my ambition with Wallace and Gromit, because I've been brought up on, you know, puppet animation being very much for kids, you know, 5 minutes before the news or whatever it was, Eastern European film on BBC Two. And it very tended to come from very much the stage puppet show sort of tradition, shot in a, you know, like everything shot in one direction, whereas I wanted to expand it into more of a movie sort of feel where you could look one way, have one character looking one way, they could turn around and you could have a shot, you build a set for looking the other way. So I wanted to more make it immersive and kind of three-dimensional in that sense, and more like a movie, which I'd never seen really, you know, stop motion done like that before.
Yeah, I mean, it had an incredible and profound impact. I think this one in particular really, I think, put Wallace and Gromit into the public consciousness. I think one of the reasons why I thought the 30th anniversary thing took me by surprise was that paradoxically, Wallace and Gromit, it feels like the Wrong Trousers came out yesterday, but it also feels like they've been with us forever.
Right.
Now, was that in a way what you were aiming for when you first came up with them? Did you recognize in them the timelessness of these characters?
I don't know if I really did, actually. I think it was just that kind of confidence of youth, really, you know, that you don't really, not too self-conscious about things in that way. You know, just wanted to make a good film and had a funny idea and let's go for it sort of thing. And, you know, I had a great crew who was totally on board and saw it. And I think it was very much led by that, really. And I'd never, you know, Grand Out, I always think of it, it was very much a student film and kind of whimsical. I didn't really know a lot about structure and, you know, story structure and character arcs and stuff. I didn't pay much attention at college. I was more just wanting to animate things that were funny and imaginative. So when Bob and I sat down, I first actually worked with a lovely chap from the Kaleidoscope, Radio 4 Kaleidoscope program, Brian Sibley, and kicked ideas around with him. And then things couldn't work out because our timing was not good, and, you know, in terms of availability. So I had to look for someone else and was introduced to Bob Baker, and a writer who'd worked on Doctor Who and stuff from Bristol. We hit it off really well, and I came along with these mad ideas of penguins and staying at Wallace and Gromit's house. There was many penguins at one point, and this pair of trousers that go wrong. but I wasn't sure quite how it all could quite fit together, and it didn't take long, really. I remember Peter Lord saying to me, because I had all these antics which were quite Tex Avery, kind of Warner Brothers, Tom and Jerry style stuff of a penguin, you know, like messing around with domestic objects, you know, like a Hoover or a food mixer. And I did lots of keep sketchbooks and presented all this stuff. I remember Peter Lord saying, what if this lodger was up to something, you know, nefarious, and we don't know what he's up to. And that really set us going in that direction of making Feathers a villain, because it was just more like an annoying nephew staying at first in the very early days.
So at one point there was lots of penguins as well, so it wasn't just Feathers.
Yeah, that was an idea that came before I was at film school, even, actually. I was at Sheffield Art School, which was back then, you know, part of the Poly. I used to, me and my flatmate would be trying to think of ways to earn money as students. And we were thinking of these like kids' book ideas that could be published, and that never happened. And one of these ideas that I was working on was an actual illustrated book of Wallace and Gromit. This was way before anything was filmed and even applied to film school, really. And I had this idea about how all these penguins, it was a penguins don't live in the north, but it was a cold winter, and all these penguins were migrating south and came to stay at Wallace and Gromit's house, a whole giant flock of them.
Amazing.
remember Pete and Dave pointing out how maybe one penguin might be a bit cheaper than a whole flock.
Yeah, precisely. But now, given that you know you have bigger budgets and the might of the BBC and funding it and whatnot, would you have done more penguins if you were making the wrong trousers too, or remaking the wrong trousers today? Would you go for a full bore with all the penguins?
Well, no. I mean, I do think often you can be given so much rope. You know, it can be bad. You know, to hang yourself, it can be bad for you, and it's a certain discipline, I think, that often is the kind of seedbed for how ideas really develop in a more mature kind of stronger. You know, I do believe that simple is usually strong, and if you're just given the whole world, it can start to get kind of weak and baggy in places. If you've got too much choice. You've got to be quite, if you do, you've got to be very disciplined even more with it, like how to focus the ideas. And also we realised, because after there was chance, after the wrong trousers, there was lots of spin-off-y type ideas being kind of encouraged. And I remember sitting with Bob and thinking, oh, mate, what could arrive next at Wallace and Gromit's house? I mean, we ended up with Shaun the Sheep in the end, which was turned out well. But we were thinking another penguin, is some another. But the thing is, feathers is a one-off.
All right, time now for some reviews. And it's a weird week, this, because it is quiet in the cinemas because everybody's running afraid of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Yeah.
So we only have one cinema release, and that is Book Club, The Next Chapter, which I referred to at the beginning of this show. Now, this is, of course, a sequel to Book Club from 2018. I know you're both huge fans.
Oh, well, of the whole geriantics genre, which is a subgenre that I'm trying to make happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that is a good word.
It is a good word. Yeah, that is, I mean, yeah.
Well, I have to say, I did not know there was a Book Club movie already. Like, I didn't, this is a sequel to a film I've never heard of.
Yeah. Why isn't it called Book Clubs?
Yeah.
I know. They haven't followed the Aliens ranking
or Books
at all.
Club.
Books Club. Yes. Ooh.
Like courts martial, amazing. Yeah. Okay, so let me explain for you.
Okay.
This is four friends who are played by Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, Candice Bergen, and Mary Steenburgen.
So far, it sounds like a remake of 80 for Brady. Or was 80 for Brady a remake of Book Club?
Brady was, I guess, a remake of Book Club, but it's with Jane Fonda and her other friends.
Right.
So she has two groups of friends, okay. And this is the other one. But yes, so it is basically in the first film, they all started reading 50 Shades of Grey. And it shook them to their core, my goodness. And it shook up their love lives and it shook up their relationships. And that's where we left them. So we now
in
come
a red
back.
Room of pain.
No, I mean, in fairness, like they didn't go that far. But it got them hot under the collar a little bit. We now rejoin them. Obviously, the pandemic has happened. There's actually a very good montage at the beginning of this to sort of show how they all weathered the pandemic in a way that is, I thought, quite relatable and quite well put together. And then basically because Jane Fonda's character, who is this kind of hard-living, hard-partying, man-eating hotel owner, finally gets engaged to her boyfriend, Don Johnson, they decide to go on a sort of bachelorette trip to Italy. They've always planned to go to Italy, and for one reason or another, it didn't happen, but now it's going to happen. And they go on this trip, and like very, very little really goes wrong, and very, very little really happens, but they have a lovely time anyway. That's basically.
Do they read any books at any point?
They do. Like, so in that opening montage, you see them reading all these books during lockdown, the kind of books everybody was reading. But one of the ones that they kind of really chime with is The Alchemist, the Paul Coelho book. So that's kind of the reference point for this, to the extent that there is a reference point.
Okay.
But it's more that they just mention some books in passing.
Yeah.
So this is once again directed by Bill Holderman, who came up working with Robert Redford as a sort of assistant and then made his way into writing, producing, and now directing with these two films. And I think it is a step up from the first Book Club. I thought it was funnier. I thought it was sharper than the first one. That's not to say it's super funny or super sharp, but it's definitely better. But at the same time, it's not like going to change your life. You know, it's just a very gentle, nice comedy about a group of older ladies having a nice time, basically.
Is it strikes me as the sort of film you would take your mum to see, or your mum would just go.
That your mum would just go to see with a bunch of her friends. I mean, she might go with her own book club. That's probably the genius of the title. Like maybe that is what it's aimed at. But it is the kind of film that feels like it was designed to be watched with a glass of wine in hand. So there's kind of a montage here when they're in Rome and they go to a bunch of art galleries and they make funny comments about all the naked statues. You know, and so
really highbrow humor.
It's not exactly cutting edge stuff, but it's quite well done because these are all, you know, actresses and actors indeed who could do this stuff in their sleep. And maybe they are.
Yeah.
And maybe that's okay at that age, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, look, it exists. I gave it 3 stars. I really went back and forth on the star rating. Yeah. You know, recommendation feels strong, but so does don't see it. That also feels strong. I feel like see it if you're the kind of person who's going to like it. Otherwise, just, you know, get on with your life. Go to Italy, maybe. Just go and have a holiday in Italy. Everything else that we're about to discuss is on streaming. Shall we start with Deadshot, given that we had Malamine on the...
Shall we start with Deadshot, a.k.a. Borderland, a.k.a. Deadshot? It is called one of these two things. On the Sky side, it is called Deadshot. On IMDb, it is called Borderland, original title, colon, Deadshot. But it's a film, and frankly, neither one of these titles make any sense. So actually, pick one. It's absolutely fine.
And it has nothing to do with the DC character Deadshot.
None whatsoever. So this takes place in the 1970s, this despite having an aggressively 1980s synth score. But this stars Amir Amin as Tempest, and he's a British Army soldier. And there is a point where he is stationed in Northern Ireland, and he is trying to take down an IRA member, played by Colin Morgan, and ultimately ends up killing Colin Morgan's character's pregnant girlfriend. And
his pregnant wife.
Sorry. Apologies.
And sorry, Colin Morgan's character, just to be clear, is Michael O'Hara.
Indeed. So no related to Helen.
No.
And so when Helen's cousin's wife is killed, he goes to Helen's house to recuperate. And meanwhile, Tempest is moved back to the UK in disgrace to avoid, a murder charge for having just shot a pregnant woman in the face. And he starts working for Mark Strong's character, hunting down IRA terrorists on the mainland. Meanwhile, yes, Colin Morgan leaves Helen's mum's house to go to cross the Irish Sea to go to London to get some revenge and take down Tempest. And you have this kind of now cat and mouse game in 1970s London. So it's fine. Like, the film is okay. I found it difficult to invest, or I should probably say, and I think this is to the film's, you know, credit is maybe not the word I'm looking for, but it's definitely by design that you don't really know at any point during this film, even up until the end, who it is you're rooting for. So are you rooting for the IRA bomber who lost his wife a little bit? Are you rooting for the British soldier who's hunting terrorists but shot a pregnant woman in the face and showed, so far as I can tell, very little remorse for most of this film? And so I struggled to sympathize with either of them. It's also, I have to say, a relentlessly dour film. I don't think, you know, every film needs to be leavened with comedy, but this is very, almost oppressively downbeat. Like, it's extremely maudlin. As I say, it has this sort of weirdly chosen, grating 80s synth score. And I think it adds to this very, very heavy mood that sort of weighs upon you all the way through. And I didn't struggle to get to the end of it, but let's just say I was quite gratified that it was only 90 minutes long. So, Ellen, we discussed this before the podcast started, and I was saying, you know, I didn't have anyone to root for, and you thought it was very much to this film's credit that it chose that route, that it decides to be kind of morally ambiguous, right?
Yeah, because... okay, like Colin Morgan is a terrorist, but as we meet him at the beginning of the film, he's actually left the IRA to be with his wife and now baby. He wants to be a father and he wants to kind of get out of that violent way of life. And then he has to get into it and he's pressured to do some of the stuff he does in the film as the IRA's price of helping him get revenge on the man who, you know, killed his wife. So, you know, he's not a sort of fanatic in the traditional sense. He's not completely immune to... the price and the value of human life. Mm. And at the same time, I think there is some remorse from Tempest. I think you do see that he is shaken up by this. And I think that you do see that he's kind of struggling to figure out, you know, his next steps. And that he is pressurized into doing what he does for Mark Strong's character.
That's certainly true, yeah.
So you've got both of these people being sort of reluctant soldiers who are forced into a position that they don't want to be in. And I think that's an interesting way to approach, you know, a very messy, muddy, gross conflict. You know, this isn't good guys and bad guys. This isn't, you know, sort of Patriot Games. this is a lot more nuanced than that. And I think that was to the film's credit. And the Gard brothers, who directed this, I think it's Charles and Thomas.
Charles and Thomas Gard, who wrote and directed,
You know, I think there's real sort of, there's real sort of nuance and real intelligence in that approach, not giving us a hero, quote unquote hero, in this film. I guess the closest we get is Felicity Jones's character, who's kind of in a complicated position in the middle.
That's also, an understatement.
Also very unsympathetic in some ways, but ultimately perhaps misled rather than, you know, absolutely morally grotesque.
Quite a small role for her. I was quite surprised to see her in a role that it felt like she's at a place in her career where you would see her playing a more substantial role in a film like this.
Yeah.
I felt she was a bit underserved by this. But look, like I say, I didn't dislike it. I think it's a morally grey, sort of politically nuanced treatment of, one would say, a morally grey and politically nuanced situation with core of human drama, right? Like, so it's made personal, even though it's dealing with larger political issues. And I think they obviously understand what they're writing about, but it just didn't seize me for one reason or another.
Fair enough.
Sorry to say, regardless of whether it is in fact a Deadshot or a Borderland.
Okay, so what would you give this?
What would I give this? I would probably give this 3 stars, I would say. I do not know if we have an official Empire review.
I don't believe we do.
We do not have an official Empire review. Well, then I have just given it 3 stars.
Okay. There we go.
I would tend to concur with that. I thought it was interestingly done, but maybe didn't quite jump off the page, if you like, in the way that I hoped. But, I mean, you know, a far cry above some of the Sky originals we've watched. So an interesting one from them. Next, on Apple TV, we have Still, a Michael J. Fox movie. Tell me about this, John.
Yeah, this is, I mean, you know, the title gives you a sense of what kind of movie it is. It is a Michael J. Fox movie in the sense that it's a documentary about Michael J. Fox, introduction, the star of Back to the Future and many other things. And this is kind of doing 2 things, really. It's a documentary about his sort of rise to stardom in Hollywood, how he became one of the biggest names in Hollywood. And you forget sometimes, because he's sort of been out of the picture a little while, like in the 80s and early 90s, he was hot stuff. I mean, he was maybe the biggest thing in the world. There's a great scene where he was cast for the sitcom Family Ties, which was his big like breakthrough. And one of the producers wanted to fire him because they thought he was too short. And they said, that guy will never be on a lunchbox. And obviously, he was on many lunchboxes.
Many, many lunchboxes.
And Michael J. Fox sent him a lunchbox a little while later with his face on it. Because he was a pop culture icon.
Yeah.
He was absolutely massive. And so you get a little insight into what it's like to be in the eye of that storm.
The secret of his success, if you will.
Very nicely done, yes. That's really interesting. And that in itself probably would make a compelling enough documentary. But obviously, there is another side to his life, which is that he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. At quite a young age, I think
really
like 29,
yeah.
I think
yeah.
he was, which is much younger than most people get diagnosed with that disease. And obviously, it's incredibly debilitating, completely life-changing. The film opens with him. The film opens in like 1990 when he first gets a tremor, when he first gets a little twitch in one of his fingers and sort of tracks how that goes. And the way it does this, David Guggenheim directed this film and he does it in such an interesting and sort of creative way. He uses a mixture of talking heads. So he's got lots of interviews with Michael J. Fox and his family. You know, there's hours and hours of chats that they've drawn from. But there's also archive footage. So they get actual clips from Michael J. Fox's movies.
And TV shows and stuff.
And TV shows and weave them in. And weave them in a sense of like, almost as if that is Michael J. Fox saying it rather than his characters.
It's really wittily done. I mean, some of those clips are so cleverly used.
And also there's like some dramatizations with actors playing Michael J. Fox. So there's all this, there's a sort of collage quality to it, which is really, really clever and really engaging. And it keeps it sort of sharp and interesting and dynamic. So that makes it really watchable. Like it's a very pacey film. It's very funny. I think the best thing about it really is it's Michael J. Fox. You get to hang out with him for a couple of hours.
And it feels like he's being very honest in the film as well. So David Guggenheim, if people don't know, directed An Inconvenient Truth, among others. But he's also married to Elizabeth Shue, who of course starred in the 2 Back to the Future sequels.
Yes.
So I imagine they know each other socially. I don't know, but I imagine that they do. But certainly they feel like they're very comfortable together.
Yeah.
Michael J. Fox seems quite at ease with him. And I think that, you know, that adds to the sense that you're getting something honest. And he's not, you know, he's quite unsparing at times about his own behavior in the past, about things, mistakes that he's made and things that he regrets. So it doesn't feel like hagiography. It doesn't feel like Heath's so great and everything I did was perfect.
Oh, he talks a lot about how as a young man, he was kind of driven by fear, right? Mm. He was very insecure and he was outwardly very confident and cocksure and, you know, witty. And inside he was just frightened, just a frightened kid. And that's, you know, exacerbated by this condition. And he's very bracingly honest about it. Mm. I mean, he's very funny. It's not a serious film, even though there's a lot of serious subject matter. Like he's always like sort of undercutting himself and every line of his, even in his current condition, you know, he's a bit older and he's not as healthy as he once was, but he's still like making jokes about himself.
Yeah.
But it's just really good to spend some time with him, you know, and just sort of get to know him and his life and you know, what he's been up to, basically. I just really like him as a person, I think. And I think after watching this, you probably will too.
Yeah.
Michael J. Fox's middle name is Andrew.
Is that true?
Absolutely true. It's Michael A. Fox.
Michael A. Fox.
Well, it was a reference, isn't it? Was it Michael J. Pollard? It's a reference to a classic movie star.
Yeah, so. That's right.
Still cool, though.
Also, anyway. Otherwise it would have sounded a bit self-aggrandizing. Michael A. Fox.
Michael, comma, A. Fox.
That's right, yeah.
Well, he was and indeed
he was
is.
And indeed
yes.
is.
And we gave that 4 stars. That's 4 Empire stars for Still. If you have Apple TV, that's highly, highly recommended. Finally, for this week's reviews, we come to The Mother. Not a description of James Dyer, but tell us about it, James.
Ah, The Mother. This is
You Mother.
You Mother. This is a film from Mulan's Nicky Caro. It stars Jennifer Lopez in a film that is essentially Taken, where Liam Neeson, Jennifer Lopez. So if you want to put it that way, if you want to be reductive, that is basically what this film is. So let me give you some context. So Jennifer Lopez has a very particular set of skills. She has served many tours in Iraq. She's become a bit of a badass. And we meet her in an FBI safe house where she's basically sitting there trying to cut a deal. And she's like, they're going to find us. You can't keep me safe. You don't know how to keep me safe. And she's absolutely right, because Joseph Fiennes turns up and stabs her in her pregnant stomach within 5 minutes of this film starting. And I have to be honest, that's quite a difficult thing to get past in a film. Like, yeah. I mean,
you don't have to get past it because he is the bad guy.
He is the bad guy, but it's like, it's a lot to deal with at the beginning. But the rest of the film, to be fair, isn't as upsetting as that particular moment is, because she gives birth, the baby's fine, spoiler. And because the baby's life will be in danger, because she has this essentially crime syndicate after her, she sends the baby off to be adopted and goes on her merry way, goes off and lives in the wilderness. So we can flash forward 12 years. The villains have come out of the woodwork. They're going for her daughter. They abduct her daughter. She comes out of her wilderness retirement to, shall we say, kill the shit out of all of them. And I have to say, she does a very, very good job of that. So J-Lo in this, like, you thought she was good at pole dancing. She kills with the absolute best of them. Like, she completely convinces as a kind of Brian Mills-esque, I will, you know, wipe the floor with you kind of badass. She's a sniper. She's got a mean knife that she stabs people with. So she murderizes a whole bunch of people in this. And that stuff's really fun. The only thing...
Yay, murder!
It is. It's a lot of fun murder. The only thing about this film that I found... some of the, shall we say, the action direction a little bit too sedentary. It lacked a certain pizzazz. It wasn't invigorating enough. So I think she's really good, but I just felt a lot of the action stuff fell flat in this. Also, this film is relentlessly stupid from beginning to end, with people making choices that make you want to bash your head repeatedly against the screen. And I found that intensely frustrating to the point where I almost couldn't get past it. That said, there's fun stuff in it. Joseph Fiennes is hamming up like you wouldn't believe. Gael Garcia Bernal is in it as a kind of like drugs kingpin. Omari Hardwick kind of plays an FBI agent who's kind of her, you know, a sort of love interest. And Lucy Pays, who plays her daughter in this. Her daughter, who I want to say his name is Chloe, but actually Zoe. I'm pretty sure it's Zoe. Yes, there we go. But look, it's a film. She kills a lot of people. Helen, did you have more fun with this?
I quite enjoyed this, just because I didn't expect much of it. But I think J-Lo, I find a really compelling screen presence. Like,
she's amazing.
She's a
amazing.
Proper movie star. And she has so much charisma. And when she does the sort of, you know, she's actually kind of played the grim kind of professional woman in a man's world kind of thing before. I mean, obviously, Out of Sight, for example, being an amazing case of it. But she did kind of convince me as somebody who could absolutely fuck shit up. Like, really, really terrifying prospect here. And I was kind of looking forward to the big finale with her two ex-boyfriends and you know, everything going wrong. But I quite enjoyed, I get what you're saying about the kind of kineticness of the action, but what I quite enjoyed was some of the cleverness of the action. I think there's some really clever kind of tactics and really clever moments in the way that she sets things up. So I quite enjoyed that. I think Nikki Caro is an incredibly talented filmmaker. And I love also that she made room for actual character work in this.
Actually, I think this is this film's strength over and above its action. I think it actually works on a better level that you've got a kind of an emotionally cauterized woman who's being forced to face up to her maternal side, which she has successfully buried for over a decade. And then you've got a child who has been brought up in a well-adjusted home, but who's trying to connect with her biological mother, and them almost meeting in the middle, where there's almost like an exchange of, hey, I'll give you a little bit of, you know, emotional resonance and you teach me how to kill people with a sniper rifle. Like, it's like that kind of cultural exchange, I think, actually works quite well and is quite touching.
Yeah.
So while I'm not 100% convinced by the action, I do think, partly because there are some great performances here, I think the emotional stuff lands quite well.
It's a lot of fun. If you're just like, you know, surfing for a movie on a Friday night, this is
good. You could do a lot worse than The Mother.
And so that is 3 stars for The Mother. I think I'm at the high end of a 3. You're maybe at the lower end.
I'm at the lower end of a 3, sure.
But nevertheless, that is, as we always say, a recommendation. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Chris again, for one. And we will also be joined by some guests that I haven't got 100% clear in my head yet. In fairness, I did ask, but I wasn't 100% clear on the answer. Sorry, Chris, if you made it really clear and I've just lost it in the giant thread of messages. That is it for this week. That's a goodbye from John.
Meg! Goodbye.
And it's a goodbye from James.
Megs!
And it's a goodbye from me. I am off to say James Dyer 3 times and see if it really does make him disappear.
Very good.
James Dyer, James Dyer, James Dyer!
I'm still here on the Pilot TV podcast this week. Rebecca Ferguson's on talking about Silo. Actually, that was last week, but it was a good interview. Listen to it.
All right.